Then the illusion in his head faded, though he still seemed to be able to catch a lingering scent. Spices, the afterglow of spikenard that he'd once been given to sniff some years ago in Jerusalem. This blinked revelation from the past quite unnerved him. The woman in his head had been so convincing it was as though she had occupied space near to where he stood. There was even a trace of smell, a change in temperature, so graphic that he had to shake his head to clear the picture. Madness, he thought. Charles, your imagination will be the death of you, his voice said silently in his head. He gathered together the papers, smiled at the sleeping Hillary, and went quietly out into the corridor. Sister Marks was at the little nurse's station at the end of the passage. She still did not seem to have a hair out of place, though incipient lines under her eyes had started to signal fatigue.
She's gone to sleep at last. I must have had a boring effect.
Oh, good, Mr. Gauntlet. I'll look in on her presently. Sorry to have got you out, but...
No, don't be sorry.
He held up a hand as though trying to stop traffic.
I'm worried. The bloke, the priest who came to see her, knows things he shouldn't. He was a bit unpleasant. I think we should try to keep a watch on her. Will the hospital security...
I'll try them, but I have my doubts. They're not exactly flush with people on the ground. They also have to spend a lot of time in casualty. It can get dangerous down there at night.
Please try them, sister, and I'll report it to the proper...
He was going to say authorities, but that sounded contrived, pretentious.
The proper people.
She thanked him again, and he told her he would be leaving Glasgow in a matter of hours. Privately, he thought it might well mean he would have to change his plans and hang around for a while. The events of the night had made him unusually jumpy and edgy. Was this, he wondered, an overreaction? The crashed Cessna was serious, yes, but some pushy big monk coming in and making unspecified threats. Well, and then he thought about the whole business of Father Gregory Scott and the bank accounts. He knew things that he reckoned others did not know about the Father Superior of the Order of St. Jerome. People change over the years, but Father Benedict was still around, Corporal Knight, as he'd been in an earlier incarnation. And Charlie was pretty sure that the big fellow was Knight's sidekick, Bertie Day. Talk about old home week. A couple of cabs were loitering out front with the ambulances. One was waiting for a doctor. The driver of the other said he was free, so Charlie took the cab back to the Central Hotel, and to hell with the expense. Nobody seemed to be around in reception. He loitered for half a minute, then went straight up to his room, dumped the manuscript, letters, and money on the bed, and dialed the OS-13 number at Scotland Yard. Being the anti-terrorist branch, OS-13 had a round-the-clock operator, and when this officer picked up, Charlie asked if by any chance the commander was in. He was, but did he have anything that warranted waking Commander Joe Bain at this time in the morning? Charlie reflected that he could probably leave it to the duty officer, who happened to be a sergeant. Without alerting too many people, Charles wanted to get some kind of protection for Hillary, and he was quite willing to jeopardize Kit Palfrey, with whom he was still supping with a long spoon. He first told the sergeant that he was Bex Oleska's husband.
"Heard you'd married her. Congratulations. How can I help?"
Which was a promising start, so Charlie went further, spinning a tale that dodged in and out of truth, and in the end did not compromise either Kit Palfrey or the monks of Ringmarookie. He reported the facts concerning the crashed aircraft, to which he added a cock-and-bull tale about some terrorist activity that was almost certainly a hangover from Northern Ireland. There were just enough facts for the sergeant to agree to the patient having some form of protection. In the end, it would be up to the local police, but Charlie felt much happier by the end of the conversation. Still sitting on the bed, he began to go through the letters, intent on opening them, if necessary, and certainly leaning on Gregory Scott if the situation so demanded. He was holding one envelope, as though weighing it in his upturned hand, when the telephone rang. He picked up.
Gauntlet.
Silence. Nothing from the other end, but the noise of an open line. Then he clearly heard the distant receiver being replaced. He jiggled the telephone cradle, and when the operator came on, he asked if she'd put a call through to him. She had. He asked more. It was a man.
A local call, she thought. Local call, foreign voice. Really thick accent. Oh, Mr. Gauntlet.
What kind of accent?
What they call Middle European. Also,
yes.
Your wife.
What about my wife?
Well, she said she was your bride, actually.
She would do. We're on our honeymoon.
Oh?
The operator found this a shade difficult.
I thought you were on your own, sir.
Sure, I'm on my own.
But your honeymoon, I...
But... Sure, it's the latest thing, didn't you know? She stays in one place, I stay in another. One day, maybe we'll get to meet. She leave a number for me?
No, sir. In fact, she specifically said she couldn't leave a number.
Okay. Put me through to reception, will you? I have to check out.
Of one thing he was certain, when somebody calls you in a hotel and puts the telephone down, there's only one reason. The caller wants to know if you are at home so that he can come round and duff you up, fill you in. This wasn't coincidence anymore. Corporal Bertie Day, as he was all those years ago, didn't hide anything. Bertie's real name was Deo Solovac. Of course, it was Beridi Deo Solovac. And he had a Middle European accent as thick as pig's wool. Glasgow Central Hotel backs onto the railway station, so having paid his bill, Gauntlet left by the exit leading onto the main concourse. From there, he walked to the taxi rank. Glasgow, like all large cities, does not sleep. In the small hours, the pulse slows, but you can still get around. Two black cabs were on the rank, and he took the first one out to the airport, which was almost deserted, yet provided 24-hour facilities for bathing and generally cleaning yourself up. So, at 3 o'clock in the morning, Charlie Gauntlet treated himself to a warm bath, for he'd always found it a pleasure to lie in hot water and allow his mind to skate freely over his problems. At this moment, Charlie could not make up his mind. He need not be involved in this, whatever this was. He muttered to himself, flicking at the hot tap with the sole of his foot. "My trouble is trunky. I'm a nosy beggar. Trunky trouble. I just have to know what's going on." A large portion of his common sense told him to give up and go back to London. Just wait there for Bex to reappear. That was really the most reasonable thing to do, but then... He closed his eyes and gave up the battle, letting his thoughts drift. London would be best. Funny, the girls in London were the most striking he could remember since the 60s, when the capital swung. Now the young and lovely women seemed to stride confidently through the streets as though they owned the planet, which in a way, suppose they did. He was incredibly lucky, he acknowledged, to have ended the century with a woman like Bex. Yes, he should go back to London so that he would be there for her when she got back from whatever she was up to. On the other hand, there was a great desire for him to be in at the kill. Kit Palfrey, one-time traitor of the month, a dodgy character to say the least, had dragged him into a series of mysteries. Charles accepted, scooping up some water and allowing it to trickle down the graying hairs of his chest, that he wanted to know how the story turned out. What happened to the woman who called herself Naomi and lived at the time when Jesus of Nazareth walked the highways and byways of Judea? If the writings were real, it might shed light on the greatest mystery facing humankind. If it was not real, if it was a fraud, well, why would Kit Palfrey even be bothering with it? Bringing those fraying bits of paper back from Moscow would do nothing for Palfrey, even if they were to be hailed as a breakthrough find. Unlocking doors to secrets, old Kit Palfrey wouldn't benefit. They wouldn't declare Palfrey for Pope, or heap the world's riches upon him. And, be fair, Kit had always appeared to act to the tune of his conscience. There was nothing in it for him, and it was a damn good story. In the end, he decided to let fate make the final call, lying in the bath until after 5 in the morning, before getting out, drying himself, shaving, and dressing. That done, Charlie went off and found coffee. A couple of hours later, he used his BT phone card and dialed the number for Rockwell Aviation here at Glasgow Airport. If someone answered, he would take it from there. Otherwise, he would get himself onto the first flight to London and let the monk stew, together with Kit Palfrey and Hilary Cook with an E.
Ralph Romeo Rockwell was at his desk, having just flown back into Glasgow from a taxi run to Heathrow. Yes, he could take Mr. Gauntlet to ring Maruki, give him an hour to juice up, file a flight plan and all that. As it happened, weather and local traffic delayed them for several hours, during which Charlie experienced great discomfort, sensing eyes on his back and possibly feet ready to trip him up as he loitered away the time. One thing he did was buy a stout envelope, and in one of the lavatory stalls, seal up the money, letters and stuff he had from Hillary, address it to himself, guess the weight, buy stamps, and stick on too many, and pop it in a pillar box. He was not going back to the island with any evidence on him. What with one thing and another, not until a little before one, on a grey, chill afternoon, with a hint of snow in the air, were they airborne, heading back to the monastery. Taciturn, he thought, easing himself into the cramped cockpit of the Piper Archer. Taciturn was the word to describe Romeo Rockwell, a short, stocky young man, whose dark, somewhat tangled thatch of hair hung low over his brows, making him tilt his chin a shade, as though he strained to see the way ahead. He had the sulky good looks of a pop idol, and about the same percentage of know-it-all, done-it-all arrogance, which did not endear him to Gauntlet. If Rockwell were a man of few words, he gave much confidence as a pilot. His hands and feet had a steady sureness over the controls, while his eyes moved constantly. He would nod when it saved him speaking, yet his speech over the radio to the controllers was clipped and clear. Charlie considered that Mr. Rockwell revealed little of the Lothario that Kit Palfrey had made him out to be, and much more the professional, safe, confident pilot that he truly was. When they'd first met in the flesh, Rockwell swiveled his eyes without moving his head and asked if they were expecting Charlie.
"I've only just come back, and yes, they are expecting me."
"Oh, yes. I always have to ask, because they're not partial to unexpected guests. Don't like people dropping in on them. If you were just there, how did you get back?" His accent was not Scottish, more Geordie crossed with Surbiton. Charlie told him, and Rockwell smirked. "Poor old Hillary. Bit of a pilot officer Prunella, Hills." Gauntlet made the connection, the old Second World War RAF term for an inexperienced or dim pilot, was pilot officer Prune, depicted in cartoons as an upper-class twit.
"Not her fault."
He found himself defending Hillary Cook.
"Never is."
This time Rockwell did not even raise his eyes. "Hillary's the kind of pilot who attracts incidents. Got lost on her first solo. Just a circuit, but she managed to lose herself.
Seemed to be doing all right by the monks."
"Sure." Rockwell obviously had little time for Hillary Cook. His tone was dismissive, and Charlie got the impression that the man was not really at ease with the monks. He wondered if Hillary had been stealing the bread from Rockwell's bowl by being in well with the Order of St. Jerome. Before leaving, Charles had left a message on the Dolphin Square answering machine, telling Bex exactly where he was heading. He also told her about the photographs that should be arriving. "Whiz them on up to Miss Readout." Though he had a distinct uneasiness about her, he had felt this restless concern since daybreak.
"Beware big monks,"
he added to the message, not really knowing why he should leave a warning. The enormous monk was here and now in Glasgow. Indeed, the man who called himself Father Martin was aware that Charlie Gauntlet was already on his way back to the monks of the Order of St. Jerome in Ringmaroke. Eyes had followed neat little Charlie across the railway station and out to the airport. Eyes were on him now, as he sat in the Piper Archer heading over the sea. And eyes would be waiting for him on his arrival at the monastery of St. Jerome on the windswept rock.